Welcome to The Business of Agriculture, a podcast created to enlighten, inspire, and inform those who work in or depend on the world's most important endeavor, agriculture. Here's your host, Damian Mason.
Greetings and welcome to The Business of Agriculture, a podcast with me, your host, Damian Mason. You know, we get together here every week and we discuss issues involved in the industry of food, fuel, and fiber. And I got another great show for you today. We're talking about ethanol. We're talking about the ripple effect of what's going on in the ethanol industry. And it's much greater, as are all things in the industry of agriculture, than most people think. We're going to be talking to Jeff Cooper. He is the CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association. That's an ethanol mostly association. But you'd be amazed what, again, is impacted when ethanol is slow. We're going to be covering all that. We're going to talk about what it means to you if you're in the business of agriculture. We'll be talking also about what it means to the consumer. We have a lot of people that are sitting around in their house right now, not working, getting their same paycheck for the last 7 weeks, and the coronavirus is entering May, for crying out loud. And they're like, well, I don't understand. Why are these shortages? Well, what the hell do you think is happening when you're sitting around doing nothing? The world doesn't just keep chugging along just because it did for you. So that's what we're covering today. As you know, the business of agriculture has been going now for over 2 years, and we are so happy that in the last 6 weeks, we picked up a fantastic sponsor that wanted to be a part of this. The company's called Harvest Profit. It was founded by Nick Horb. He's a good dude. He's a North Dakotan, but it doesn't matter where he is. He serves clientele, 600-plus customers in 26 states and 4 provinces. What Nick set out to do was to create a company that would help farm and agricultural enterprises be more efficient. It's a software solutions company to make you more profitable, to track your marketing, your inventory, et cetera, et cetera. You can check them out at harvestprofit.com. Okay, talking ethanol. Jeff Cooper, you heard the introduction. Thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for having me, Damian.
All right. I read an article in Forbes. That's how you and I became acquainted. And I've worked for ethanol companies as doing speaking engagements for them, but I didn't know of you. And I read this article in Forbes that talked about something crazy that's going to happen. There's going to be a dearth, a shortage, a lack of CO2, carbon dioxide. And it talked about the ethanol tie-in to why there will be no carbon dioxide and why that matters. So before we get into that, which is the real reason you and I met, because I need CO2, because CO2 is a major ingredient in my favorite Coors Banquet beer. Before we get into that, let's talk about what you do for the RFA and what the whole ethanol industry means to America.
Sure. Well, I'm the CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association. I've been in the job a little more than a year, but I've been with RFA for close to 10 years. Prior to that, worked for the National Corn Growers Association. So I've been around the ethanol industry and focused on ethanol policy issues for really the better part of the last 15 years. The Renewable Fuels Association is a trade group. We represent primarily ethanol producers. So the ethanol plants are our member companies, and we represent their interests on Capitol Hill, but also, you know, marketing, advertising, and just educating the public about who we are and what we do in the ethanol business every day. So, you know, the ethanol industry is a very important sector in the agricultural economy. We support about 350,000 jobs annually. We got about 200 plants across the country, contribute about $40 billion to the nation's gross domestic product. And certainly, you know, corn growers know that the ethanol industry has been one of the largest, if not the largest market for corn in the last several years. About 5.5 billion bushels of corn typically go to the ethanol industry here in the last few years.
5.5 billion bushels of corn.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. I love numbers. I'm an ag econ guy, but I want to make sure that I give a brief pause, Jeff, because in the United States of America, because there might be someone listening to this who like sells cotton. There might be somebody listening to this that's in the cranberry business, and they're saying, again, just like the news media tells us that we should all be clamoring for safety and not leaving our house because 60,000 people have died of coronavirus. If you give the numerator without the denominator, it always sounds interesting. By the way, 60,000 deaths is tragic. However, we lose 8,000 Americans per day in just any given day. It's actually 7,779 Americans die every day in a normal year. So if you do the math, it's not really that big of a deal. 5 billion bushels of corn is pretty substantial. By my math, that's about one third of our annual production here in the United States of America. Am I right?
Yeah, that's right. We typically say somewhere between 35% and 40% of the corn supply ends up going to ethanol. At least it's been that way the last 5 years or so. So it is a very substantial market for corn. And obviously, when we have disruptions and problems in the ethanol sector, like we're seeing right now because of the coronavirus, that has dramatic impacts on the corn market because we are one of the largest users of that product.
Okay, so that's where we got. Now we've got some parameter here. And I think we should point out, Jeff seems like a good dude, but he's from Wyoming. And I just want you, for those of you that don't travel much, ethanol is corn is ethanol. Those two go together, you know, peas in a pod, but you don't have one without the other. Everybody, well, are we making ethanol out of fiber based on reed grass? Well, maybe somewhere, but not in the United States. If you're using ethanol, it's from corn. But here's the thing. Why did they get some guy from Wyoming? There's like 4 acres of corn in the whole damn state of Wyoming. Why are we getting some Wyoming? I'm from Indiana, one of the top 5 corn producing states. Why are we getting some Wyoming guy to talk about ethanol, for crying out loud?
Hey, as you know, all of us in agriculture are very interrelated, right? I grew up around cattle and sheep, and cattle have a very close relationship to the ethanol industry because we make a heck of a lot more than ethanol in an ethanol plant. One third of that bushel that goes in the front door of an ethanol plant comes out the back door as animal feed. And most of that goes to cattle feeders, very high protein, you know, low cost source of protein and energy for those animals. I'm a Wyoming guy. We actually did grow up around a little bit of corn. We chopped some for silage every year. But I also went to college in Iowa. So there you go. That's where my corn bona fides came from, maybe.
I appreciate you. I appreciate your breadth and also bringing that all together. Go back to that thing for somebody that maybe doesn't keep up. Cause this is like that thing where you and I know it, but a lot of folks they're good. They're working in the industry, but they didn't know it. Roughly one third or a little more than that of our corn production in the U.S. goes to ethanol, but then one third of that comes back out the back end of the facility. And that is in, tell them what that is in the form of.
Yeah. We call it distiller's grains and typically, it's dried at the ethanol plant, so it can be shipped long distances, and that really helps with the shelf life of the product. But if you're feeding it locally, you don't have to dry it. It's sold as what we call wet cake. And so in places where there are high concentrations of cattle on feed, places like Nebraska, Kansas, a lot of those ethanol plants don't dry their distiller's grains. They sell them wet to the local feeders, and that helps reduce costs. But yeah, I mean, distiller's grains is a very important product for our industry. You know, 20, 30 years ago when this industry was starting out, it was sort of thought of as a byproduct. Today, we consider it a co-product. It's a very important part of the sort of the margin structure and just the overall output of the ethanol industry.
And if you're marginally involved in agriculture, the initials that you'll hear a lot of times are, Jeff.
Yeah, DDGs. Yep. And that's distillers dried grains is what that acronym stands for. But there's various forms of distillers grains. There's wet distillers grains, there's modified. So we typically just refer to that whole category of feed coming from the ethanol industry as distillers grains.
And what happened? Well, okay. So we put up these ethanol plants in mass starting late 90s, really early 2000s to mid 2000s. And there are a few within a stone's throw of my farm. Like I said, some of them have been my clients. I can think of CIE, Central Indiana Ethanol, which has been a client of mine, a Poet, which is just down the road from my farm. And then there's another one about maybe 35, 40 miles from my farm. So there's three within 45 miles of my farm. Very important in the Corn Belt with these things. You said, how many plants are there around the United States that make ethanol?
There today are 204 ethanol plants across the U.S. Most of those, as you might imagine, are located in the Corn Belt. Iowa, Indiana, Illinois, Minnesota, Nebraska, Kansas. But we do have facilities in places like California. There's half a dozen ethanol plants out there. There's 4 or 5 facilities in the Texas Panhandle. There's a couple of facilities in New York. So it isn't just a Corn Belt industry. It is a nationwide industry. I think we have ethanol plants in about 30 states today. But obviously the, you know, kind of critical mass and ground zero for the ethanol industry is right in the heart of the Corn Belt.
How many ethanol plants are in Wyoming?
There actually was one ethanol plant in Goshen County down there in southeast Wyoming for
and they had to close because there's only 4 acres of corn within 150 miles of their facility. I get it. All right, so okay, and I gotta tell you, I really appreciate having people from different aspects of the ag industry coming on here, because sometimes I'm not as knowledgeable, but oftentimes I'm a little more knowledgeable than obviously many, because I keep up with ag and I speak to different groups. I was trying to think of the other one that's been a client of mine. They have their facilities in Muscatine and Washington, Indiana.
Grain processing. Yep.
Yeah, there you go. GPC. Anyway, about this business. We are shut down now, and we got the triple. This is what a lot of folks are like going, wait a minute, why are those plants shutting down? What's the problem? Well, this is where the real ripple effect needs to be kind of explained. I was on an airplane because I could still travel in early March before it became illegal to travel for events. And I saw this whole thing begin to melt down. I'm like, oh, this is not good. Saudi Arabia got into a pissing match with Russia. Am I right in saying that? And yeah. Saudi Arabia has one product in the world to sell. In the United States, we got everything from Google to Nike to food. I mean, you name it. What Saudi Arabia got? They got like 12 or 16 million residents, which is less than the state of New York and less than the state of Illinois. And they got one product. What's that product, Jeff?
Crude oil.
And what did they decide to do in early March to upset the crude market in the whole world?
Well, it's the same thing that Saudi Arabia and their other friends in OPEC have been doing for years, which is manipulating that market. And when Saudi Arabia saw things headed a certain direction in the oil market, they decided to just open the floodgates on crude oil production. They are the lowest cost producer in the world, and they know that. So they just started putting the hammer down on oil production, trying to smoke out some of the other producers around the globe, Russia being the big one that you talked about. So there's kind of a price war, race to the bottom with Russia. And, you know, the collateral damage that kind of caught in the crossfire was the U.S. oil producers, the shale guys. That have been very competitive and growing very quickly in the last decade or so. But when Saudi decides to just put the hammer down as they did a few months ago, it really left some casualties in the U.S. oil market that just couldn't compete.
Mr. Cooper, since you're around it every day and many are not, there's an obvious tie between ethanol and oil. We invented the ethanol industry for two reasons. One, we had a whole bunch of corn to get rid of. And two, we decided we were not going to be beholden to countries like Saudi Arabia or Iraq or Iran that are hostile to the United States of America. Right. Thing is, we also, at the same time, we ramped up oil production. Most people don't know this. What's the number one producer of crude oil in the world?
Well, I mean, in the last couple of years, it's been neck and neck between us and Saudi Arabia. It kind of changes from month to month, depending on what's happened. But yeah, the last year or so, it has been the U.S.
Yeah, so a lot of folks wouldn't know that. The United States went from being in the 1970s, if you're old enough to remember. I've lived through three gas energy crises. When I was a little boy, Northwest Elementary School, we were allegedly going to run out of coal. Because there was no mining going on and we had all kinds of crazy. I remember we all had to wear jackets and sweaters in school and only turn on one strip of lights because there was no electricity. Then I remember the gas crisis of the mid 70s, the late 70s, at least a couple through the 80s. It's been crazy. So I've been around this, and you have too. Turns out the United States of America isn't only not running out of gas, we're making more of it than the rest of the world. Well, Saudi Arabia doesn't like that because they got, did we not say this? What's Saudi Arabia got?
They got crude oil.
They got one, product. So they just, what's that?
They got lots of sand, too.
Sand and crude oil. So what do? They say, let's just glut the market and, as you said, smoke out a lot of folks and then have a pissing match with Russia because Russia's a great big producer. Who got caught in the crosshairs particularly over this whole oil fight?
Well, aside from the U.S. producer, the U.S. oil producers, the ethanol industry got caught in the crosshairs because, again, our product is blended with gasoline that's made from crude oil. And the last 10 years, 12 years or so, ethanol prices have been lower than gasoline prices. And so refiners have had, it's been in their economic interest to add ethanol and use it for octane and get that octane rating of their gasoline up. But when oil prices fall to, $10 a barrel, $15 a barrel, or even go negative, now you've got a situation where gasoline is now cheaper than ethanol. And so the signal that sends to refiners is, hey, don't use any more ethanol than you have to. And so that's the problem that we've been running into here the last several months, as the Saudi and Russia oil price war kind of collided with coronavirus at the same time.
All right. We won't get into the weeds too much in this, but there was a thing that started back during the Bush administration, carried through the Obama administration, is still kind of up in the air. It's called the
Renewable Fuel Standard. Yep, the RFS.
And explain that real quickly in a nutshell.
Yeah, well, the RFS is a program that requires refiners in the U.S. to blend increasing amounts of renewable fuels like corn ethanol year by year. And it did, it was adopted by Congress in 2005. At a time when we were importing about 60% of our crude oil. It was extended and expanded in 2007, and Congress established very specific numerical kind of volumetric requirements through 2022. And then beyond that, it's up to EPA to determine what those volumes of renewable fuels will be.
The RFS right now is still requiring these refiners to put our stuff in it, but a bunch of them got waivers. So that cut back on demand. And tell them about the waivers real quickly.
Yeah, so there has always been a provision in the Renewable Fuel Standard law for small refinery exemptions. And that was intended, again, at the beginning of this program to give those smaller refineries, the ones that produce less than 75,000 barrels a day of crude oil, to give them extra time to prepare for compliance with the program. And so if they could demonstrate to EPA that, hey, complying with the RFS is going to be hard for us and it's going to cause us financial hardship, then EPA could turn around and give them an exemption for that year. It was meant to be a temporary program, but here we are, 12 years on, and EPA is still giving out these exemptions to small refinery waivers and not just giving a few of them. Under this administration, we've seen a massive increase in these exemptions, and really any small refinery that's come looking for one has been getting these exemptions.
Which then, of course, means that they don't have to use ethanol. So we've been getting hurt as an industry in ag, and you've been getting hurt specifically as ethanol for the last
Few years anyway. And so we look at what EPA has done with these small refinery exemptions. And for the 2016, 2017, and 2018 RFS compliance years, if you add all those exempted volumes together, it's about 4 billion gallons of demand or blending requirements that were exempted in those 3 years. And that's a lot of volume considering that we produce about 16 billion gallons a year.
Is that that's about 16 billion gallons of ethanol per year. Is that the number? Another thing that struck me there. Go ahead.
We produced a record 16.1 billion gallons in 2019, and that was the highest ever. But we've been kind of between 15 and 16 billion gallons the last several years.
What really struck me, and I'm sure that my listeners are saying, you were struck by something? Yeah, I was struck by it. You said a government program that was meant to be temporary somehow never went away, and I'm so shocked. I mean, kind of like the income tax that was begun in 1913 temporarily, that it didn't go away either. I mean, does this happen? Or government programs like the waiver program, just they don't go away, do they?
Well, and that's the thing. It was always intended to be temporary, and it did. I mean, it kind of went away for a number of years, and then the refiners, they're very clever people. They sort of reminded this administration of this program, and it's a loophole, and they kind of jammed their foot in it. And got some help from the EPA, and like I said, we saw a massive number of exemptions. We actually sued EPA over these exemptions, and took them to court and won. And so they hopefully should be winding these exemptions down moving forward.
I feel really bad here because at least 4 minutes ago, I was supposed to mention that this episode of the Business of Agriculture is brought to you by my friends at Harvest Profit. Harvest Profit is a Fargo-based software solutions company for your agricultural enterprise. You don't need to take my word for it. I'll be honest with you, I don't use their software. You know why? Because my agricultural enterprise is so small, I still use a notebook, pad, and pen, and manila file folders. But if I were a legitimately big-time operator, I would use their stuff because I don't market my own. My hobby beef operation is like a dozen steers. I don't need software for that, but you do. If you're out there operating as an agricultural enterprise, you need software that'll help you become more profitable, manage your numbers, dot your I's. In times like this, you've got to have every nickel accounted for and maximize every opportunity you have. Why not have a great partner? HarvestProfit.com, founded by my friend Nick Horb. He's a smart dude, and he can help you. 14-day free trial. Go to HarvestProfit.com or call them up. Tell them Damian Mason sent you. Okay, his name is Jeff Cooper. He's the CEO of RFA. That is the
Renewable Fuels Association.
And which is mostly ethanol. Ethanol, however, is not the only product that comes out of an ethanol plant. The reason that I first was introduced to you was an article that I read about 5 days ago about carbon dioxide.
That's right.
All right. I'm concerned about this because carbon dioxide is two of my favorite products on earth are Coors Banquet beer for the end of the day and Coca-Cola Classic from somewhere between 10:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. I got to make sure I down about two or three of those to keep my energy level up. Coca-Cola Classic needs CO2. Actually, that's why I love Coca-Cola. Don't you admit it, Jeff? Pepsi is basically like syrup. It's like you might as well get the Aunt Jemima's out and like put a straw in it, whereas Coke has effervescence. Okay, so I
tend to agree with you on that one. I'm a Coke Zero guy.
Okay, so our products, be it Coors from Colorado, be it Coca-Cola from Atlanta, whatever we're talking about here, it needs CO2. CO2 is used in every carbonated beverage. Most people don't think about this. Tell me about the carbon dioxide shortage we're going to have because of the ethanol plant closures.
Yeah, and again, this is a story that people just don't understand. When they hear ethanol industry, they're thinking, you know, fuel, ethanol, and that's it. I mentioned earlier, when you put a bushel of corn in the front end of an ethanol plant, one-third of that mass comes back as animal feed. But I didn't talk about the other two-thirds. Of those other two-thirds, one-third becomes the ethanol. That's what goes into gasoline and goes into your fuel tank. The other one-third, during that fermentation process, becomes carbon dioxide. And we have a number of ethanol plants that actually capture that CO2. And then they sell it to, you know, companies like Airgas and Praxair and Air Liquide and these merchant gas companies. And you'd be amazed at how many uses there are for that CO2 product. Not only is it, you know, the bubbles in your banquet beer and in your Coke, but it is also used in meat processing. It's used in food and beverage processing, dry ice manufacturing. You know, it has applications in the medical field. It's used as a refrigerant. They use it at wastewater treatment plants to help balance the pH. So, you know, we hear a lot about CO2. It's usually in a negative light, but CO2 is a product that has a lot of uses across our economy, and the ethanol industry plays a huge role in supplying that CO2. About 40% of the nation's CO2 supply comes from the ethanol industry.
That is why, you know, you are such a gifted interviewee. I was just about to ask you, okay, we don't get all of our CO2 from ethanol, but we get a significant part. And I was going to ask you how much. Where's the other 60% come from, if not from ethanol?
You know, some of it comes from natural geologic formations. There's places where you can just, you know, basically pull CO2 out of the ground and out of the atmosphere. But there's also ammonia plants is a significant source. And petroleum refineries is another source. But the single largest source of CO2 is the ethanol industry. And again, about four out of every 10 tons that's captured comes from the ethanol industry.
Okay. Now, this is the thing, like you said, Jeff, most of the time we hear about CO2, you know, you got Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez that, you know, and she's talking about cow farts, which is methane, by the way, it has nothing to do with CO2. Right. We're talking about greenhouse gases. But we need this stuff. We need it to make our beverages, but also, like you said, if you look at the back, the working part of a hospital or an industrial facility, there are commonly big tanks. What's in those tanks? Oftentimes,
A lot of CO2. Yeah, it does have broad applications.
Okay, so here's the thing. The article that I read where I found out about you said like 42 of our, you told me we got a couple hundred ethanol plants, but not all of them are in actively producing CO2. But of the 40 some that are, yep, a bunch of them are offline, not even operating right now.
That's right. So out of those 200 or so plants that I mentioned earlier, about one quarter of those facilities typically capture CO2. So we got about 45 ethanol plants that capture CO2. Well, three quarters of those facilities are either idle today, or they have greatly reduced their output. And here's the thing, you can't make CO2 unless you're making ethanol. And so if we have facilities that are shut down and they're not making ethanol, they're not making CO2. And obviously the reason that we've got ethanol plants shut down, in fact, we have about half of the industry shut down today, is because
half of ethanol right now is shut down.
Yeah. Out of those 200 plants that I told you, about 70 of them are completely idle, not producing a drop. Another 60 or 70 have greatly reduced their output. And that leaves, you know, the other one third of those facilities operating near normal rates. But if you look at the capacity, we could produce 17 billion gallons of ethanol over the course of a year if everybody was running flat out. But we're operating today at a rate of about 8 billion gallons. So slightly less than half of our capacity is being used.
And then we're also at a big deficit then on the CO2. So before we get to the economic impact of ethanol, I want to talk to you about the CO2 thing. The CO2, do I need to run to a welding supply facility and just hoard like it's toilet paper? Do I need to be doing that?
Well, and you just mentioned another use of CO2 that I forgot. Welding and you know, metalwork is another place where that's used. We are going to see shortages of CO2. I'm just sorry to say that, but that is what's going to happen. And the users of this, the end users of CO2, are really ringing alarm bells right now. Yeah. About the lack of product that they're seeing. There's not a lot of days of storage of CO2 out there. And so storage is being emptied, and it's not being backfilled in many cases. And we're going to see some shortages. And so what that means is the cost of CO2 is going up. If you can find it, it's priced very high. And in other cases, it's just simply not available. And the brewers, and really all the users of CO2 tell us, hey, if we don't have CO2, we're not making beer. We're not carbonating, Coca-Cola. We're not able to make dry ice to ship, meat and other refrigerated products. And so, it could result in some impacts to the consumer that right now aren't really being, considered by the average, the average Joe and Jane who is drawing their payccheck.
It's just like the meat. It's just like everything. Damien, why is this happening? I can tell you why. Because when you shut down large swaths of the economy, there's an interconnectivity of everything. Hey, Mr. Cooper, so a question I got for you then is, besides running out and hoarding this so that I can keep my kegerator going, the bigger question then is, what about ethanol coming back on? There's a lot of economic devastation. Rural America gets hurt. All we ever hear about, the New York national media, which is synonymous, they're the same thing. And we have to hear about that. We got folks out here in rural hinterlands. That ethanol plant is an economic engine for them. What's going to happen?
Yeah, it absolutely is. There's a lot of the ethanol plants across the country, and particularly here in the Midwest, where the ethanol plant is the largest employer in the county or in the local area. And when they're not operating, those people aren't going to work. And there's typically, 50 to 60 people that work directly at an ethanol plant. But there's, think of all the other jobs that are affected by the presence of that facility. There's all sorts of maintenance and suppliers and vendors to that facility. There's the local farmers that are buying and feeding the distillers grains that now can't get that product.
There's the local farmers that are selling their corn to the facility, and it's one more place for them to take bushels of corn and dump it in the receiving hopper. Then there's the economic part of it, and like you say, it's just like the company that does business with that ethanol facility. What do you see happening? We got corn now approaching a two in front of it. And if you're not a corn person, if you want to know what that means, when we start talking about devastation, when you say a two in front of it means if we get under $3 and we might be getting there. And all of a sudden, what's our cost of production? What, 340, something like that, probably?
Yeah. It is going to be devastating to the corn market, to corn farmers. This lost demand, as I mentioned earlier, we talked about 5.5 billion bushels of corn being consumed by this industry on an annual basis. When only half the industry is running, if it stays that way for a long time, we're talking about, hundreds of millions, if not billions of bushels of lost corn demand. We see corn exports are doing well. Feed consumption is doing fairly well, even with this latest hiccup. But the reason corn prices are tanking is because the ethanol industry is shutting down.
So. Well, there's another component of it too. When you're euthanizing piglets, the one thing, and I'm not an animal science major, I'm an ag econ major, but the one thing I did learn in FFA livestock analysis and production, dead pigs don't eat. I remember learning that. So we've got an issue on the demand side for all of our agricultural outputs, particularly corn and soybeans. When you're euthanizing animals, they will never eat those bushels. Right. I'm on the record as saying ethanol was a short-term solution to a long-term problem of too much corn. Anybody who's up my stuff knows I have said that ethanol, while I support it and it's good for the industry, I've just said it's not going to be here for the long haul because we're going to have electric cars and because Saudi Arabia has one product to sell. They're not going to let corn farmers in Illinois put them out of business. I will say to all of our ethanol friends, I never said it in a mean way. I just said that we're going to have challenges. Here's the thing. I sure as hell never thought the challenge was going to be shutdowns because of coronavirus, shutting down the economy. Give me some thoughts.
Well, I think I would certainly disagree that the ethanol industry and ethanol market is only a short-term sort of flash in the pan for the corn market. I think the ethanol industry is going to be around for a very long time. We're going to continue to be a major user of corn, if not the top user of corn in the future. We consume about 140 billion gallons of gasoline in this country year in, year out. Now, we got the COVID-19 thing, and that's going to put a big dent in gasoline consumption this year. But if 10% of that is ethanol, that's 14 billion gallons of ethanol. We're quickly moving higher than that. We're moving to E15 nationwide. We think within the next 5 to 10 years, that's going to be the new normal. There's still some E85 being sold out there. But the other thing you got to remember is outside of the U.S., there's about 260 billion gallons of gasoline consumed around the world. So today, about 2 to 3% of that market is ethanol. If we got E10 like we have here in the U.S., if we got that worldwide, that's a significant boost in demand for ethanol, and we are seeing growth in our export markets. I'm not going to debate that the electric vehicle is coming, but I think that's a matter of decades, not years, before we see everybody driving a Prius around. It's going to be a long time before I trade in my F-150 for a Toyota Prius or some kind of electric vehicle.
You and I both agree in somewhat. I think electric vehicles will be here a little faster than 30 years from now, but I'm probably not going to be buying one either. I will tell you that the world somehow thinks that this is the future because I just read that Tesla, that has had two profitable quarters in the last 12 years or four profitable quarters in the last 12 years, is worth three times as much as GM and Ford combined. Let's see, this company that is electric car company has never made any money, but it's worth three times the two biggest. I'm with you. But I think there's going to be some challenges for ethanol anyway, just because of the bigger thing is the oil producers like Saudi, they don't want to be put out of business by corn farmers in Illinois.
That's true. And we have always had our hands full with that other competitor on the playing field. And they're a bigger, stronger competitor, always have been. But here's the thing about ethanol is we have some properties, unique properties and characteristics that oil doesn't have, and gasoline that's refined from oil doesn't have. We're the highest octane component available on the market. And when you pull up to a gas tank or gas pump and you see that 87 octane, the last several points of octane are coming from ethanol because it's the cheapest and cleanest source of octane out there. That's going to continue. Refiners like ethanol. They don't like to admit it, but they like ethanol because of its very high octane value and its low cost octane.
Yeah,
it does. Find a barrel of crude oil.
It's kind of like they don't want to admit it, but they actually need it. Here's the bigger thing. What can we do? Because this CO2 thing might be the more pressing need. We're not going to run out of gas, whether the ethanol plants are going. We sure as hell might run out of CO2, which is a component for a lot of stuff from industrial to healthcare to food and beverage. So I say, first off, go and buy some go pull into the pump that's pumping ethanol. But what else can we expect? Because a CO2 shortage, nobody's even thought of that. And is Trump going to say, executive order, you got to open up plants so we can make CO2?
I tell you, we're not really too fond of the idea of the president invoking the Defense Production Act to pick and choose what ethanol plants can run and say, you know, these plants that are capturing CO2 can stay online and the other one's got to stop. Yeah. We think what we're beginning to see happen is a lot of these customers, a lot of these users of CO2 are working with the suppliers, working with the ethanol plants to make sure, you know, whatever is needed to get these plants back online is what they're talking about. Typically, you know, I'm not going to say these ethanol plants have just sort of given away the CO2 in the past, but I mean, they're getting $8 or $10 a ton for it. It's about one penny per gallon in terms of revenue. It's been, kind of out of sight, out of mind. Today, when the users are coming to these ethanol plants saying, hey, we'll give you $150, we'll give you $200 a ton, we need that product. In many cases, that could be enough to cover their losses, cover their operating costs, get them back up and online.
An economic solution, Jeff, is now it becomes the ethanol isn't worth much, but the CO2 is, whereas before CO2 was my manure and I had my milk. Now it's going to be the manure is worth more than the milk, right?
It's been fascinating to watch. In the past, all of the co-products, distillers, grains, CO2, corn oil, you add all those together and they've been about 20%. Of the net revenue for an ethanol plant. The other 80% is coming from the ethanol. In the last few weeks, we've almost seen that invert in some cases, or at least we've seen sort of a 50-50 split, because not only is the CO2 in high demand and short supply, but we're seeing that with the distillers grains as well. We've seen DDG prices skyrocket because cattle and hog feeders and poultry producers, they've formulated their rations to include some amount of distillers grains, and they don't want to change that. They don't want to lose that distillers grain supply. It's interesting that the co-products or the byproducts have really become the primary products during this pandemic.
I have a prediction based on reading that article. That was actually where I was going to go with this. I think CO2 might be the blood that the money that they need in the finishing out this year. It might be the reason that ethanol plants can make it to 2021 is because of the CO2, because of America's need for food and beverage, less than gas.
It's a crucial product. There are certain industries that cannot survive without it, certain products that are not going to be on the shelves without it.
Any closing thoughts on that? Is ethanol going to make it?
Ethanol is going to make it. We're going to be around for a long, long time. This is a very resilient industry. We've been through lots of ups and downs before. Never seen anything quite like this. It's been pretty nutty. But we're going to pull through this, and the industry will be stronger than ever before. The only other thing I would mention is, don't forget about this too. Hand sanitizer. 60% of this product is ethanol. So we've seen as demand for hand sanitizer has gone up because of this crisis, we've seen a lot of our plants switch over and make some of that alcohol that's suitable for hand sanitizer.
I think that, I believe that 1 year from now, there are going to be people, and then 10 years, when grandma dies, they're going to find out that she had an entire closet. There's going to be like 41 gallons of hand sanitizer. I haven't bought hand sanitizer in 3 years. First off, you can't right now. I have a little jug of it in my truck for if I go hunting. And I can't wash my hands. So like if I clean a deer, I have a little bit. That's all I've gotten by with now for the last 2 months. So by the way, you maybe can send me some. All right. His name's Jeff Cooper. He is he's really gracious to be joining us here. He's the CEO of the Renewable Fuel Association. This episode of the Biz of Agriculture, again, brought to you by my friends at Harvest Profit. Go to harvestprofit.com. They are a company that came up with one idea that the founder had, one idea: help agricultural enterprises be more thorough, be more efficient, be more profitable through how they track and monitor their expenses, their income, their business, their marketing. It's a software solution that will help you be more efficient with your grain marketing and your profit analysis. It's harvestprofit.com. Go there, check them out, tell them I sent you. I'm the author of Food Fear. If you haven't picked up your copy, please do so. Just sold 58 copies of it today to a client that wanted to buy a bunch of books for their employees, a nice way for them to outreach during the coronavirus. Their employees are stuck at home and say, hey, we're thinking of you. It's a little morale booster, so you might consider that. And also, you can always check out the Biz of Agriculture on YouTube. That's right. For the last 2 months, we've been putting all of these episodes as a video up on YouTube. The playlist is Business of Agriculture Podcast. Go to my YouTube channel and subscribe so you'll be alerted when these come out. It'll also help our visibility. Jeff Cooper, thank you for being here.
Thanks, Damian. It's been a lot of fun.
I really appreciate the education. Until next time, it's the Business of Agriculture.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Business of Agriculture, please share it with your network. Be sure to connect with Damian on LinkedIn, like his Facebook fan page, and follow him on Instagram and Twitter. For speaking inquiries or to purchase Damian's books, Food Fear, or Do Business Better, go to DamianMason.com.